Hi, this is Dr. Kelly Brogan, and today we will be mapping serotonin on the 15-minute matrix.
Welcome to the 15-minute matrix. I'm Andrea Nakayama, functional medicine nutritionist and your host. This is the podcast that brings you bite-sized insights and lessons on how to use the most important tool in functional medicine and functional nutrition. Today on the 15-Minute Matrix, I'll be in discussion with Dr. Kelly Brogan. Dr. Kelly Brogan is a Manhattan-based holistic women's health psychiatrist and author of the international and New York Times best-selling book, A Mind of Your Own. She completed her psychiatric training and fellowship at NYU Medical Center after graduating from Cornell University Medical College and has a BS from MIT in systems neuroscience. She's board certified in psychiatry, psychosomatic medicine, integrative holistic medicine, and is specialized in a root cause resolution approach to psychiatric syndromes and symptoms. Kelly debunks the myths about serotonin's powers, and we're going to dive right into the neurohormonal milieu in this conversation, so do get your thinking caps on. Welcome, Kelly. I'm really excited to have a conversation with you today about serotonin.
Totally happy to be here.
Let's start by talking about what serotonin is, and I'm definitely going to want to talk about what serotonin is not, but can you presence for us what it is physiologically and maybe even how it has an impact on the body?
Yeah, so I was a neuroscience major in college and then went on to train as a psychiatrist. So I am steeped in a lot of, I'll go so far as to say, assumptions about the way that the brain works. But most of us who have taken any time to sort of delve into the science of particularly psychoneuroimmunology have come to understand that there's much more that we don't know than what we do. But suffice it to say that there is a bit of a reductionist perspective that there are primary neurochemicals that are sort of guiding, maybe marionetting our behavior at any given time, right? So serotonin is one considered to be one of the chief ones, along with norepinephrine and dopamine. And, you know, there's some sort of a nod to GABA. And then, you know, we've sort of come to learn that there are more than 100 neuropeptides that are active. And so thinking about this rubric of just a couple, you know, sort of at the helm of our behavioral, cognitive, and mood-related states is a bit of a problematic assumption, which we can talk about. But my teaching was that serotonin is responsible for mood states. It's the happy chemical. And, you know, it's hard for me to not delve into the next part of the story, which is that, you know, that is loosely, if at all, evidence-based claim. But that's certainly what, even in my, you know, very fancy medical school and residency training, I learned that it's primarily and chiefly responsible for mood-related states, but that also we happen to know that it's very active in the enteric nervous system, so that, you know, perhaps the vast majority of our bodily stores of serotonin are active in our gut.
Right.
And there wasn't really much explanation as to the potential meaning of that in my conventional training, but, you know, there is some interesting literature coming out suggesting why that might be.
So definitely that piece is important, I think, for people to understand that relationship of where serotonin is mostly, is it manufactured or stored in the gut? How would you articulate that?
I love that question. Yeah, so it's manufactured in a place called the Raphe nucleus, in the brain, actually. So its presence and a real even like dominance in the gut is curious and probably was one of the early indicators of gut-brain bidirectionality and physiology before we even had a means of appreciating that, mm-hmm. you know, through players like the microbiome, for example, or even an understanding of you know, the relationship between the immune system and neurochemistry. I mean, when I was in medical school, which wasn't that long ago, we didn't even know that there was immune activity in the healthy brain. You know, lymphatic vessels in brain tissue were discovered in the past couple of years. So that means that, you know, all of us were trained under the assumption that a healthy brain is immunologically quiescent. And of course, that has been, you know, turned on its head by right. the understanding that the brain responds to systemic alarm, including inflammation, including, you know, gut-related triggers, and that the brain also signals itself to the body. So that's this bidirectionality and to the gut itself, which I think is intuitive, obviously, for most people who've ever had like butterflies, you know, in right. their stomach or diarrhea or something or nausea. But a lot of the sort of newer evidence, I would say, and Andrews et al. Out of Canada are doing a lot of this research, points to serotonin as potentially being sort of an early response factor, so a stress resiliency indicator, and that actually having elevated levels of serotonin is an indication that the body is trying to reallocate energetic resources. Hmm. This is a totally different theory than the PAT assumptions that are driving the use of SSRIs in the conventional realm, and also challenges some of the more holistic assumptions that, you know, working with serotonin precursors like 5-HTP and tryptophan is potentially a good idea. And, you know, Andrews and their group argues that, you know, we look at high serotonin states like serotonin syndrome, carcinoid syndrome. We look at even some of the evidence on schizophrenia and autism. And if we begin to explore the effects of antidepressants, we have a better understanding that high serotonin states are actually largely pathological, if not stress adaptive, right? So if not perhaps at best indicative that there is a homeostatic effort underway. And this is obviously a very different, you know, sort of perspective. And what's interesting to me, just to sort of cut a bit to the chase, is that, you know, in my sort of researching and challenging what I learned as a conventional doctor, I went back to PubMed and dug through, you know, what is essentially 60 years of research right. on the monoamine hypothesis, it's called the low serotonin equals depression hypothesis, and sort of came up with my hands empty. And I turned to people who had already done this kind of digging, you know, psychiatrists like Joanna Moncrief, their researchers like Leo Lucas, and other psychiatrists like David Healy. And, you know, they came to the same conclusion that actually there is no evidence, valid evidence for the serotonin theory. And the birth of it was actually surprisingly ignoble, you know, that it was like observations around the mood-related effects of anti-tuberculosis medications that were thought to interact with the monoamine system as inhibitors. And you know, perhaps regulate serotonin trafficking, that they induced euphoria. So that must mean that this class of medications could have mood elevating effects.
I'm curious, like, what led you on that hunt? Like, as a clinician, were you seeing that the quote unquote evidence that was leading us to believe that serotonin was a fix for mood disorders wasn't working? And what was it as a clinician that kind of woke you up to go down that research rabbit hole?
Well, it was probably what has woken up any of your interviewees,
right?
Which is a personal health experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I bumped up against the glass ceiling, so to speak, of what conventional medicine had to offer my Hashimoto's diagnosis, I began to learn what naturopathic medicine and holistic medicine had to offer. And because of that, I said, well, wait a minute, maybe there was a lot more that I wasn't taught. And it was through, you know, sort of lifestyle change that I put my own diagnosis into remission. And mm-hmm. I said, well, what more to the story is there? And at that same moment, a colleague gave me a book called Anatomy of an Epidemic by investigative journalist Robert Whitaker.
Mm-hmm.
I read this book. It showcased a number of naturalistic longitudinal studies that are non-industry funded and makes the unequivocal argument that, and again, he's an investigative journalist with no agenda, that psychiatric medications in all classes, so from benzodiazepines to hypnotics to antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, antidepressants, stimulants, that they are, in fact, inducing recidivistic pathology. They are making people chronically ill.
Right.
Right? And I was like, ready to hear that because of the experience I had just had. Trust me, otherwise the book would have ended up in the garbage. And I read this book, and it turned me on to a whole body of literature I'd never been exposed to. And again, you know, I don't really have any original ideas, but I think I am a pretty good curator and I can consume a lot of content. And so I just hit the books and I started reading all of these scientists, NIMH level scientists, neuroscientists who have come out and said there is no evidence for the monoamine hypothesis. It's time to move on. And of course, this was 20 years into the cytokine theory, which is the inflammatory hypothesis of depressed states. Based on an evolutionarily adaptive mechanism underlying depression, for example. And so, you know, here I was learning about 20-year-old science that I was hearing about for the first time, never heard of in my entire training. So I really was just able to, sort of rediscover what had already been discovered, but by people who, you know, perhaps hadn't been able to get the word out very extensively.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think I'm a huge stand for is how the body and the physiology itself is our evidence. And that's sort of what you're speaking to when we go back to how does the body really function as opposed to what is now considered evidence-based medicine that has a lot of funding behind it. When we do that, it's like what Dr. David Jones calls Icarus's new wings. Like we're looking for something outside the body as a solution or a quick fix, and we're missing the point of what is actually happening in the biochemistry. So I love that you're saying like you actually found the evidence, and the evidence exists when we look at the biochemical pathways and how the body actually functions, and that's what led you to curate your theories of addressing depression and what serotonin isn't. So when we go back to that question of how serotonin as a neurohormone interacts, you're talking about resiliency. Is there a kind of chemical reaction that you could speak to in terms of what serotonin is in terms of the hormones?
The role of serotonin is, I think, just now being elucidated and probably is going to have a significant relationship to cortisol. Once we work it out, you know, we know that epigenetically SSRIs, so selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, antidepressants, have a specific effect on cortisol receptor sensitivity. And that is probably why and how they have this sort of blunting effect, I'll say, in a lot of folks, not everyone. And that could be interpreted as some sort of a desirable effect for some, but that's also probably what accounts for what I have, you know, dedicated my practice to, which is the withdrawal phenomenon that accompany tapering off these medications, which are unique, in my opinion, in the pharmaceutical realm in terms of their withdrawal potential. And I think it's potentially related to the cortisol level impact. Because what I find is that when people taper off these medications, their stress response, their autonomic reactivity, they develop a kind of, you know, what I would call dysautonomia that is so profound that I've literally said that it looks, you know, it can look like acute onset AIDS, where all of their, you know, immune level vulnerabilities, neurologic vulnerabilities, everything comes to the surface and they, you know, develop a disability almost, you know, medical level disability that is so profound you could never imagine it was sourced from Prozac, you know, or Zoloft. So how could there not be that relationship? And that's sort of the conclusion that I've independently come to, but I actually haven't seen a ton of literature on this. I will just say that, again, the same group has done some research trying to understand the effect that SSRIs do have, right? And what they argue is that much of the effect that we are seeing may have to do with the compensatory response, postsynaptic response of glutamate. So they think that, you know, a lot of what we're seeing in terms of what people are experiencing as short-term effects of antidepressants, which are different from their long-term effects, has to do with the way the glutamate system responds to the tonic changes of inhibiting serotonin reuptake. So that's theoretical at this point. You know, they certainly have some, you know, basic science reason to be claiming that, but we're just beginning to understand the role of serotonin. And sometimes we do that through, you know, the medication model.
So what about that short-term versus long-term? Is there a place for SSRIs in therapeutic care, or would you take a roundabout route almost all of the time that has to do with what I call the skills arena of the matrix, where we're working with diet and lifestyle and meditation and breathing and all the things that do impact the epigenetics? Is there a place for an SSRI?
Yeah, I was, you know, one of the biggest believers in pharmaceutical medicine, and would have considered myself actually quite like adept at polypharmacy, which is the standard of care in psychiatry, mm-hmm. you know, multiple medications for a single patient. And so I understand why it would make sense to imagine sort of taking the edge off, starting out with a medication. The problem is that once you actually delve into the evidence, the nails in the coffin are so many that I actually, you know, find it impossible from a scientific perspective to justify prescribing under any circumstances. Mm-hmm. So when I read that book, I never started a patient on medication again. And that was in 2010. And I have enjoyed outcomes in my practice that are apparently history-making, because when I publish them in, you know, peer-reviewed journals, the feedback I get is that there's never been a case, you know, of resolution of, you know, psychotic, suicidal, self-injurious, bipolar disorder off of medication, for example. And so I have come to deeply appreciate the power of exactly what you teach, which I do not believe to be secondary to a pharmaceutical under any circumstances. And so because I, you know, I have experience working with the sickest of the sick, I know that a deep commitment to and belief in the wisdom of the body's innate healing response is what underlies these quote unquote miracle outcomes. So the problem with you know, what surfaces when we look at antidepressants just briefly is that their efficacy is not what we are led to believe, because so much of the quote unquote negative data is hidden in locked file drawers. And anytime anyone does a meta-analysis that recruits through the Freedom of Information Act, all of that unpublished negative literature, you know, they literally are an embarrassment in terms of their efficacy. The role for belief, expectancy, and what's often called the placebo response in psychiatric outcomes is not to be underestimated. This is a major, major, major player. There are a lot of elegant studies that demonstrate that what you believe is happening happens regardless of whether you are taking a sugar pill or an antidepressant.
Right.
And, you know, the long-term data is really incriminating. The long-term data suggests that you would be better off in terms of functionality. We're not even talking about, like, are you enjoying your life, experiencing, you know, expansive emotions? We're just talking about functioning. You would be better off never touching a psychiatric medication than to take one long-term. The long-term data is really problematic because of the capacity for these medications through the homeostatic response mechanisms embedded in the body to induce a compensatory state that is worse than the state that you entered into mm-hmm. the medication relationship with.
Right.
And that has all sorts of names, like tardive dysphoria. This is totally real. It's in the literature. This isn't just a matter of, like, skeptical opinion. But what really led me to put down my pad wasn't actually in that book, was more that I learned about in terms of the potential for these medications to unpredictably induce pretty heinous acts of impulsivity and violence.
Right.
Not a very sexy topic, I know, but, you know, in as of yet, unpredictable way, through something called akathisia-induced impulsivity, which we think relates to 2D6 cytochrome polymorphism. So people who become auto-intoxicated sometimes within one dose of psychiatric medication, but specifically we'll talk about antidepressants, and who go on, like your nice uncle, like your neighbor down the street, the librarian, who go on to like murder their children, you know, stab their spouse, hang themselves in their garage, in a state of intoxication. And we don't know if that's going to be you. And so I have, you know, I have a large activism related effort, you know, collecting these tragic stories that could really happen to any one of us. So how can we justify from a public health perspective or an individualistic, you know, first do no harm perspective, the prescription of these medications until at least we work that out, especially when we have inexpensive, you know, lifestyle-based interventions that have myriad side benefits and that, you know, I myself am among others who have demonstrated are efficacious for even some of the most severe pathology.
So. Yeah. So I want to point out how you're talking about how an SSRI could be a trigger and a mediator for states that we don't want to induce. I know I have so many questions for you, Kelly, but one last question, you know, since we're speaking to practitioners in the 15-minute matrix and the patient population believes that SSRIs are going to solve the problems, what's one bit of advice you would give to practitioners of all sorts who are seeing patients who are coming in asking for an SSRI?
Well, you know, it's pretty simple because it's the sort of clinical commitment we've all made, right, to informed consent. And you, as a prescriber, have an obligation, you know, or even someone who might inform about prescription medications, you have an obligation to provide patients with the full breadth of available information when it comes to risks, benefits, and alternatives.
I celebrate always, Kelly, just what an activist for the truth that you are. And you're not afraid to speak out and to speak into that truth. And the truth is based in science and the real evidence of how the body works. So thank you for the work you do. As you know, like I am such a huge fan and a supporter of everything you stand for. Thank you.
The feeling is totally mutual.
The 15-Minute Matrix is brought to you by me, Andrea Nakayama, and the Functional Nutrition Alliance. The 15-Minute Matrix team includes my son, Gilbert Nakayama, on sound production, Renee Hunt, Natalie Merrill, and Christine Shook. You can visit us and hear more episodes at 15minutematrix.com. That's 15minutematrix.com. And we can always notify you of new podcast episodes if you go to 15minutematrix.com/notify and let us know you'd like us to let you know. And hey, I'd really appreciate your feedback on iTunes. How are you liking the episodes so far? You can give us a review on iTunes and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. And if I could, I'd send you lots of love, roses, and certainly raw chocolate. But please do know I'm grateful for your feedback. Speaking of feedback, you have an open invitation to email us. We want to know who you'd like to hear on the podcast and what you'd like to see mapped on the 15-Minute Matrix. You can email us at ask@15minutematrix.com. And if you're curious about the Functional Nutrition Lab curriculum, email us there as well. We'll make sure to direct you to the right resources. Again, you can email us at ask@15minutematrix.com.
I even you know, have seen, and I've republished on my own site, and madinamerica.com has this kind of information, people who have written up what a true informed consent would look like. And it would involve, you know, talking about the limited evidence base for efficacy. It would involve talking about unpredictable risks of violence. It would involve talking about the fact that these medications can be extremely habit forming, you know, to an extent where it could be potentially disabling to come off of them. So it would talk about the fact that the long-term data is really dismal. And then, you know, you would have to let that patient make their own decision. I certainly don't believe in coercion. I don't believe that we are here to tell people what to do. But I do believe that there are literally millions of people, patients on the planet today who wish that someone had had the wherewithal and, yes, and maybe even courage to tell them more of the story if they knew it. And the problem is most people don't. But obviously, if you've been listening, now you do.